I'm Christopher Lydon with a shocking slice of history that we didn't know going into Afghanistan after 9/11. It's riveting, it's rueful reading as the United States prepares to get out of Afghanistan after more than a decade of war. This is Open Source, an American conversation with global attitude, we call it. This is the third conversation over several years with the great historian of the British Empire in India, William Dalrymple. His acclaimed new narrative is the story of Britain's first Afghan war, 1839 to 42. The Return of a King is about a mighty British invasion, regime change, puppet government, people's resistance, an Afghan insurgency that defeated the most powerful army of its day and massacred British forces almost to the last man. It's the story, too, of a horrific war of retribution and revenge that came after. William Dalrymple, before we plunge, is it true that you signed a copy of this book for President Obama?
I did. Whether he ever reads it remains to be seen. I was at the White House yesterday. He was in Mexico, but I signed a copy for both he and Joe Biden. One inscription read, "I wish I'd written this 10 years ago," and the other read, "A lesson from history."
What if you'd written it 10 years ago and he had read it?
I think if he had been in charge, which of course he wasn't, it was Bush, but if someone had read it 10 years ago, I would have hoped that they would think twice about going into Afghanistan, which is the most obvious lesson to take away from this book. Interventions in Afghanistan rarely end well, but this particular one I'm writing about, 1839 to 1842, ended in the most spectacular catastrophe and humiliation for the invaders imaginable.
You've rescued that story, which you all have heard of, but out of the snow and the clouds and all the cliches about Afghanistan as the place where empires go to die. I mean, you've made it very clear. The fighting characters on both sides, contemporary letters and diaries, the stakes. And of course, it reads like a stark preview of coming attractions.
The storyline in this book, in a nutshell, is Britain's largest, greatest imperial catastrophe in the whole history of its empire. Spurred on by these Victorian equivalents of the neocons, this forward policy hawks who want to seize Afghanistan, the 19th century equivalents of Neil Ferguson or Daniel Pipes urging the imperialists on to seize this territory, beat Russia, capture the high road, they say, between Iran and China, between Samarkand and Delhi, capture that, and the markets and of Central Asia and the people of Central Asia are yours. And unnecessarily, and contrary to their own interests in many ways, the British do indeed put a huge army into the field and head off with this enormous force, with 100,000 foot soldiers, 30,000 camels. Brigadier brings 40 camels just to carry his uniforms. There's 300 camels carrying the regimental wine cellar. There's 30 camels just carrying cheroots and cigars. One camel goes all the way into Afghanistan carrying nothing but eau de cologne. And this sort of Victorian, it's ridiculous, Victorian army seizes Afghanistan, as you guys did in December 2001, with greater ease than anyone could have imagined. But just as has happened in more recent times, an easy conquest gives way to a very uneasy occupation and a very expensive occupation. This, I think, is the key, in fact, that successive occupations of Afghanistan have failed, not ultimately because Britain in the 19th century couldn't rule Afghanistan, because they in the end were able to come back and destroy the country. It isn't either that you guys have actually been defeated in the field. It is that you've come to the conclusion that it's so difficult, so expensive, and so bloody that it's simply not worth it. It's a calculation that you made, which the Victorians also made. And the high point of British humiliation comes in 1841, when there is this uprising, which is totally unplanned. It's brought about finally. There are many reasons that make it a popular uprising, because the people are irritated with the British on a whole variety of fronts. That they've sidelined Shah Shuja, who they regard as their legitimate king. They have taken states from the nobles. They're drinking, they're whoring in the streets of Kabul. They're outraging Islamic sensibilities on a whole encyclopedic range of issues. But the final straw is when Alexander Burns, the British deputy governor, runs off with the girlfriend of Abdullah Khan Atchaksai, who's a leading nobleman. And he turns up outside Burns' residence, burns the house down, cuts Burns into pieces, kicks his head around like a football, then hangs up what remains of his body on a meat hook in the bazaar. And this the British don't react to this, and this begins the floodgates are open. Within a week, 100,000 Afghans have gathered inside Kabul. They capture the British food and ammunition stores, which have been stupidly kept near the old city. And the leading British general is hopeless. Lord Elphinstone gets onto his horse, falls off his horse. The horse falls on him, and that's the end of Elphinstone. It's not one of the great military moments. And in the retreat from Kabul, 18,500 men, women, and children leave Kabul officially under safe passage that they've been granted by the court. 6 days later, one man makes it into the gates of Jalalabad. There's one survivor of the entire army. And the most sort of tragic things that happen, as well as large numbers of being killed and left to die in the snow, is that 5,000 of the Indian sepoys get sent off as slaves to Central Asia. The Uzbek traders are sold these guys. They sew horsehair ropes through the clavicles of these poor Indian sepoy infantry soldiers and lead them, tie the other end of the rope to their saddles and lead them off in this manner, bound to the Central Asian slave markets in Bukhara. And the British leave them to their fate. There's not much else they can do. So it's a disgraceful and terrible story. Those who've got frostbite are simply left. The Afghans strip them naked and shove them out into the snow, where in the end they have to resort to cannibalism to survive. And so a story of unbelievable suffering, failure, ignorance, and totally unnecessary. But for the Afghans, this is their great national liberation struggle. What Michael Collins and the Easter Rising is to the Irish, what Washington and Yorktown is to you guys, what Gandhi and the Salt March is to India, what Battle of Britain, Trafalgar, Waterloo is to the British, this is to the Afghans. And Wazir Akbar Khan, who led this uprising, is the national hero of Afghanistan.
Even now,
the main diplomatic area is named after him. While the ancestor of Hamid Karzai, Shah Shuja, is regarded as Afghan's, the man who sailed Afghanistan down the river. He's the Quisling. I personally think that's unfair. I think he was a much more remarkable man than that. But that is how he's remembered. And therefore, you can't understand Karzai's sort of extraordinary outbursts against America unless you understand that he has to distance himself in order to get elected. He is an elected leader. And in order to get elected, he has to distance himself. He can't be seen to be the Quisling and the puppet of America. He has to put clear blue water between himself and you people.
But to me, the simple moral is that the invaders define the battle just by being there and occupying the place, and the locals, in the end, have to win it, whether we call them tribes or Taliban or Islam or anything else.
I think the way to understand what's going on in Afghanistan now is to understand that the West, America, Britain, all the other allies, intervened in a pre-existing civil war. We intervened essentially, whether we realized it or not at the time, and we certainly didn't conceive it as that. I mean, we went in imagining we were taking on Al-Qaeda. But in reality, we intervened in an existing civil war. We intervened on behalf of the northerners, that is the Uzbeks, the Tajiks, and the Hazaras, in behalf of the cities, and on behalf of the western-leaning elements in Afghanistan. We set ourselves up against the rural Pashtun Islamist South. Now, the Pashtun Islamist South is a large part of the country, and in an election, in the sense that they are a very significant bit of the country, maybe a third of the country. So, without realizing it, in a sense, we took sides in the conflict which was already existing.
Let me ask, as an American can't read your book, Willie, without asking, how did we come to reenact so much of the British Empire at its worst? The military bullying and the blundering above all.
It is an astonishingly similar situation, and I'm one of the main surprises And one of the, I mean, with a growing sense of horror, you read this history and see how it's being replayed. There are differences. I mean, the important difference, perhaps the single most important difference, is that Hamid Karzai is a democratically elected leader with a broad-based support group. He's a Pashtun who is supported by a whole variety of Uzbeks, Tajiks, and others. And he has shown again and again that although his family is corrupt, although his rule is inadequate in a whole variety of ways, although the country remains locked in poverty, he's nonetheless a relatively popular leader with a higher percentage of the vote than your prime minister, than my prime minister and your president. I personally hope that when America withdraws, that he does manage to, or his successors who represent what he represents, manage to find a new lease of life. I mean, I personally found Karzai when I met him. He'd read my book and summoned me to Afghanistan because he was very intrigued about it, his great-grandfather, and wanted to ask me more about it. In the end, it turned out, in fact, he knew far more than I do in all sorts of aspects of his life. He was able to quote his poetry and diary and all this.
Yeah, but I'm thinking the more...
He's made out in the American press to be this kind of half-mad, sort of bipolar drug addict who is deeply ungrateful for the blood and treasure that America has expended on his behalf. I thought that he was a highly cultured man. He quoted Rumi, Hafiz, Saadi, as well as Robert Frost and John Betjeman. And to have remained in power in a very difficult situation, caught between his own people and America for 12 years, he's no fool. I'm not saying he's an angel either, but...
My question is also broader and includes Iran. Includes Iraq as well as Afghanistan. Why the United States keeps carrying the bag for the ruins of the British Empire? Somebody said to me the other day, the rule should have been, whenever the United States finds itself in a place with an English cemetery, get out.
It's a very good little phrase there, and you're quite right. There is an extraordinary number of places where America simply seems to be putting its Humvees where our Solotopes once were. And that's certainly the case in Afghanistan. You're replaying our mistakes and you're replaying our errors. There are good things which have come out of this occupation. When you go to Kabul today, you see fleets of children heading off to school every morning. Large, large numbers of children heading to school. It is the fastest urbanizing country in Asia. Kabul has quadrupled in size since 2001. There's a whole generation of educated, young, wired-up, techie children who would naturally listen to Radio Open Source if they knew about it and it was in the right language, who would be your natural listeners. I mean, all sorts of good things have come out of it. It's not a total catastrophe. What it certainly is, though, is a tragic series of missed opportunities. In 2001, America had the sympathy of Afghanistan and the world. America was popular, the Taliban were hated. You had an opportunity to develop the country, and if you had spent even one thousandth of the money you spent on landmines, weapons, rockets, bombs, predator drones, on schools, hospitals, roads, dams, and electricity production, America and Afghanistan would both be in a very different place to where they are now. And that is the tragedy of it, that it is a terrible, terrible lost opportunity, and history has repeated itself unnecessarily. There is no inevitability about history repeating itself. The fact that it's taken the trajectory it has is through a series of major errors that have happened.
Certainly what we learned from your book is that what we learn from history is that we don't learn from history. I keep
wondering... Aldous Huxley famously remarked.
But I keep wondering why the Brits, instead of teaching us the sorrows of empire, have beguiled us with the phony lures of empire, including Tony Blair. He, above all, Neil Ferguson in a particular way in the writing trade, but very broadly, why isn't England a model of the lessons learned about empire?
Well, I hope that this book certainly does teach a few of the lessons.
And give you credit. Plenty of credit for changing that tune.
There are innumerable historians in Britain who are teaching this thing very well. The trouble is that the only ones that seem to get published in the United States are Neil Ferguson. I have to say, Neil, he's my compatriot, we're both Scots, I think he's a very clever guy. He's a very smart guy. I have made my differences with him very public in a whole variety of ways, but as a performer on stage, as a performer on television, as an intellectual who can articulate ideas in an accessible manner. I admire him more than I can say. I disagree with almost all his politics. In fact, his politics are almost the exact opposite of mine.
There's the sorrows of empire, and then there's the damage to empire. Isn't it arguable that Britain, for all the huge loss in 1841-42 in Afghanistan, came out of it better than we will? They were the dominant power. They were still rising in China. The United States, after Afghanistan, confronts a rising India and a rising China. What is the overall damage of the Iraq and Afghan wars to us?
Well, I don't think that the Afghan war has been responsible either for the rise of China or India. I mean, obviously, that's a separate issue. That this happens to have happened at a time when your moment in the sun, when your share of the world economy, is now beginning to decline, just as Britain's did after Afghanistan. I mean, 1840 was our high point. By the 1860s, the German economy had kicked in. By the 1890s, your economy had kicked in. And by the Second World War, our dominance of world economic power, policy was over. You're reaching that point, the beginning of that road now. What I think is the crucial blowback from Afghanistan is what's happened in Pakistan. And what's happened in Pakistan is terribly important. You now have a country radicalized from top to bottom, from not just the beardy Islamists who are ranting about women in burqas and throwing acid in the face of girls in miniskirts, but through to the most educated members of the middle class who go to literary festivals screaming and shouting against America for the drone attacks and a whole variety of sins they attribute to your country. And the radicalization, possible fragmentation and nuclearization of Pakistan are three of the great nightmares for this region in the foreseeable future. Pakistan is not in a good place at the moment. Economically, it's completely screwed. It's still run by an army obsessed with its competition with India. And yet it's a competition that it can never win because India is growing every year by the size of the Pakistan economy. Each year, it adds on economy the size of Pakistan to its portfolio. My greatest fear for Afghanistan's future is that we will see an Indo-Pak proxy war. What's happening in Kashmir, that will happen now in Afghanistan. My final word, I suppose, on this would be to tell you what happened on my last journey.
You've done a lot of what we call the Archives of the Feet out there.
The Archives of the Feet provided many adventures, and I had a lot of fun doing that. But we had this fantastic conversation following the route of this death march. This march, which in 1842, 18,000 British and Indian troops set off. 6 days later, only one man makes it through to Jalalabad. I thought I couldn't write this book. That's the emotional heart of it. I had to follow the route. And when we finally got to talk to the elders of Jagdalik, Gundamuk, which was the site of the British last stand, where the last Brits stood in a square, fought to their last bullet, all that sort of stuff, I asked the elders there whether this war felt the same to them as the British War of 1839. And this is what they said. It's exactly the same. Both times the foreigners have come here for their own interests, not for ours. They say we are your friends, we want to help, but they are lying. We are the roof of the world, said one of the others. From here you can control and watch everywhere. Afghanistan is like a crossroads for every nation that comes to power, but we do not have the strength to control our own destiny. Our fate is determined by our neighbours. Then one of them told me a story. He said, last month, some American officers called us to a hotel in Jalalabad for a meeting. One of them asked me, why do you hate us? And I replied, this is the elder speaking, because you blow down our doors, enter our houses, pull our women by the hair, and kick our children. We cannot accept this. We will fight back, and we will break your teeth. And when your teeth are broken, you will leave, just as the British left before you. It's just a matter of time. What did he say to that, I asked. He turned to his friend and said, if the old men are like this, what will the younger ones be like? In truth, all the Americans here know their game is over. It's just their politicians who deny this. This is the last days of the Americans, he said. Next, it will be China.
And you'll be there to write the story.
I hope. Inshallah.
William Dalrymple, thank you for this conversation and thank you for this marvelous book, The Return of a King, about the British Afghan wars in 1839, 40, 41, 42. Thank you. It's been a great pleasure.
Thank you.
Mary McGrath produced and edited this conversation with William Dalrymple. The Return of a King, about Britain's first Afghan war, is the third volume of his trilogy on England in India in the 18th and 19th centuries. Our conversation isn't over until open source listeners, that's you, add your two bits in a comment on our website, radioopensource.org. I'm Christopher Lydon. Thank you for being part of the project.